A reading from the Holy Gospel according to John. The testimony John gave when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask, "Who are you?" was the absolute statement, "I am not the Messiah." They questioned him further, "Who then? Elijah?" "I am not Elijah," he answered. "Are you the prophet?" "No," he replied. Finally, they said to him, "Tell us who you are so that we can give some answer to those who sent us. What do you have to say for yourself?" He said, quoting the prophet Isaiah, "I am a voice in the desert crying out, 'Make straight the way of the Lord.'" Those whom the Pharisees had sent proceeded to question him further, "If you are not the Messiah, nor Elijah, nor the prophet, why do you baptize?" John answered them, "I baptize with water. There is one among you whom you do not recognize, the one who is to come after me, the strap of whose sandal I am not worthy to unfasten." This happened in Bethany across the Jordan, where John was baptizing. The Gospel of the Lord. It's tempting to speculate about what the human relationship between John and Jesus was. A few days ago, we heard once again the story of the Visitation, which raises a question. After Mary learned of her own wonderful pregnancy, unusual pregnancy, and that of her cousin Elizabeth, she went to visit her. Why? The angel told her about Elizabeth's condition, but didn't tell her to go and visit her. Why did she go? There must have been some bond, some relationship there that drew Mary to Elizabeth. Perhaps she went to offer her help because of Elizabeth's old age in her pregnancy, or perhaps Mary went to a trusted older cousin to seek her advice, her help in Mary's own unusual situation. Whatever the reason, you're led to ask, were there any more such visits? Did, for instance, Mary and Joseph on their way back from Egypt stop by to visit Zechariah and Elizabeth again? Or in later years, as Jesus and John were going up, did she again visit Elizabeth, Mary again visit Elizabeth, so that the boys came to know one another and grew up perhaps as boyhood friends, close cousins? It's interesting speculation, but today's gospel and other references of Jesus and John to one another don't back it up. They seem very impersonal. Today's gospel makes it seem that John is not really aware of who the Messiah is, but just that he is unworthy to unloosen his strap. He is proclaiming his coming, but unworthy to unloosen the strap of his shoe. That's rather unusual language for a favorite cousin to use about a kinsman. Jesus, in no way that is described in the Gospels, collaborated with John. That's a favorite term we have today, collaboration in ministry. Jesus and John didn't collaborate in the Gospel language. John was the forerunner. His job was to point the Messiah out. He did that. The Holy Spirit descended, and John faded from the scene. The language is very deliberate, very purposeful, to show that John's was only a passing ministry, while Jesus was the ministry to remain. The lack of collaboration between the two isn't typical of Jesus' way of acting. Jesus, one of the first things he did was to invite 12 of his followers to become his closer friends, his apostles, the ones to whom he gave more thorough instruction, to whom he presented the truth in plainer language than he used in talking to the crowds. He sent them out to continue his mission of preaching and healing, even while he was still alive. And then, after his death, they continued their collaborative mission with Jesus and with one another, and that is thoroughly described in the Acts of the Apostles and in the Epistles. The church's ministry has been, from the beginning, one of collaboration within the church. A good example of that kind of collaboration is found in the lives of today's saints, Basil the Great and Gregory of Nazianzen. They were two young men from different towns, but they really were not, the two towns were not that far apart in what is today Turkey. They first met one another, however, in Athens, where they were both gaining an education. After they finished their education in Athens, I want to say that they were college buddies, only except what we think of as college didn't really exist in those days. You attached yourself to one or another of the great teachers and pursued him. But after they finished their studies, they returned each to their hometown. Basil to Caesarea, and Gregory to his father, who was bishop of the town of Nazianzen. Basil quickly became a popular teacher, and he was befriended by the bishop of the town and eventually baptized. Remember, in those days, adults were baptized, not children. After his baptism, Basil desired more and more to follow a stricter, more eremitical kind of life, and he spent several years traveling around Syria and Palestine and Egypt, visiting monasteries, and finally he came back to the area of Caesarea and established his own monastery, calling people he knew and Gregory to join him in a stricter kind of life. As fellow monks, Gregory and Basil did collaborate. As a matter of fact, they produced together a new edition of the work of Origen for the use of the newly liberated church, because we are talking about the times right after the release of church from persecution by Constantine. Basil was eventually moved to the position of the bishop, or we should say archbishop or exarch or patriarch of Caesarea, because it was a large and powerful see, largely by the influence of Gregory's father, who was a bishop in the neighboring town. Basil, in his position, then asked his friend Gregory to be bishop of one of his, what we would call, suffragan sees. Gregory did not like his new position. He missed being away from a more metropolitan area, and he did not like the people, and he simply left and went back to assist his father, the bishop in Nazianzen. That was a beginning of parting of the ways, of not parting of the ways, but of the different characteristics of the two men showing forth. And they were different men. Basil was a great teacher and a wonderful administrator, but Gregory's first love and greatest talent was as a preacher. He has left us in writing more sermons, I think, than any other saint of the time, than any other doctor of the church of the time. He wrote especially in a clear, forceful fashion about the outstanding theological dispute of the time about the Trinity and how to talk about the Trinity. And here, there was another disagreement between Basil and Gregory because they used somewhat different language in expressing the role of the Holy Spirit in the Trinity. The Western Church has tended to follow Gregory's use of the word homoousion, while the Eastern Church has tended to follow, even to this day, Basil's use. Once again, they disagreed. But when the Great See of Constantinople fell open, it was through Basil's influence that Gregory was made Patriarch of Constantinople. And when the people did not receive him well because of his strong anti-Arian sermons, when he was exiled by the emperor, it was Basil who once again exercised his influence to have Gregory reinstated. Basil and Gregory, we celebrate together, not because they agreed on everything, not because their policies or their talents were the same, but because through it all, they aided, assisted one another, and maintained their friendship. I think they stand for us as a model of what collaboration in ministry should be about today. And I think it can be expressed no better than in the final words of Gregory's tribute to their friendship. Speaking of their student days, he said, "If it is not too boastful to say, we found in each other a standard and rule for discerning right from wrong. Different men have different names which they owe to their parents or to themselves, that is, to their own pursuits and achievements. But our great pursuit, the great name we wanted, was to be Christians. To be called Christian. May that always be the pursuit of those who collaborate in ministry."